This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The positions of the presidential candidates on the war in Iraq, national security, and the economy are foremost in the minds of voters during this election year. But always lurking behind the major issues of the day is the insignificant, albeit irresistible, question, which sports do candidate X and candidate Y prefer? A primer on the proclivities of potential President John Kerry by ESPN, the magazine's Peter Keating, is on newsstands now, and he joins me now on the line. Peter, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
In May, you accompanied Mr. Kerry on a flight from Boston to Las Vegas and had the opportunity to talk with him about sports. Did you ever find yourself thinking to yourself, my gosh, this is an odd thing to be talking about in the middle of a presidential campaign?
I have been interested in politics and written about politics for many years, and I had the distinct sense that Senator Kerry had to be convinced a little bit that this wasn't utterly frivolous. And as I was sitting there, it took all my willpower to not begin asking him about his health care program instead of, Sammy Sosa or Mark McGuire. But having said that, we didn't even ask sports policy questions like what steroids should be banned or, you know, should baseball's antitrust exemption be lifted. We just wanted to ask some regular sports questions for two reasons. One is we just wanted to see what kind of guy he was. I mean, that's what our readers are interested in. That's sort of something that hasn't been explored too much. And the other thing we were thinking is by just sticking to some basic questions about playing sports and being a sports fan, we might be able to get him to loosen up a little and show us what makes him tick.
When you asked Senator Kerry if he would name his athlete of the 20th century, his pick was cyclist Greg LeMond. Do you think that answer indicates a willingness to understand sports phenomena beyond the U.S. borders?
My first reaction was, oh, my goodness, what a blue state answer. You know, I don't know how many people in Alabama and Mississippi watching college football even know who Greg LeMond is. But, yes, number one, sort of a horizon beyond the borders. But also, number two, it's very telling because it's an endurance sport. And the discipline, particularly the mental discipline required, is just amazing. And also, you know, Greg LeMond was shot in a hunting accident and came back to win the Tour de France after that.
Mm-hmm.
So in all of those, like the comeback quality, the endurance, the mental discipline, it's a telling answer for Kerry.
When you asked Senator Kerry about his favorite sports movie, he mentioned Slapshot, Seabiscuit, and Breaking Away. Perhaps no surprises there. But Newt Rockne, All-American, surely a Democrat can do better than to cite a film where Ronald Reagan was the star.
He mentioned, if you count, I had to go back and count them after I was done. He mentioned seven movies, ranging from Newt Rockne, All-American, to The Water Boy, which of course featured Adam Sandler, and he interrupted me twice as I was attempting to proceed on to further questions to continue naming movies. I think Slapshot is the one. He just started cracking himself up. He talked about the scene where they take the Coke machine out on the ice, and he actually used an expletive to describe how funny the scene was. I mean, I tell you, it really showed the good and the bad side of giving seven answers to a question.
I'm sure you've seen footage of Presidents Clinton and Bush the Younger accompanied by Secret Service agents out on morning jogs. Should John Kerry become president, will he be able to find agents who can keep up with him as he participates in his favorite sports, namely hockey, soccer, and windsurfing?
It's funny you say that because there are not many people who are accomplished at both downhill or alpine skiing and snowboarding. You don't need very many people who even attempt both. He does both, and he does them both at a pretty high level.
Mm-hmm.
He might have to tone that down a little. He might have to tone down the sort of solitary sports that he does, and either work out indoors. You can play on fields that are sort of cordoned off. But it's much tougher to do once you actually become president. I mean, you know, President Kennedy had a swimming pool. Kerry's not that kind of guy. He's an outdoorsman, and he told us that he'd already missed the fact that he couldn't get guys together for a hockey game. It's not like when you're campaigning in Bismarck or St. Louis, you can just bring up your old pals and say, let's go out and skate.
Right.
So, yeah, it's an adjustment.
My senior producer has witnessed a hockey game starring John Kerry, one of these charity affairs, and his assessment is as follows. Good finesse player, cannot or will not muck it up in the corners. Can this be said to be, representative of Mr. Kerry's character beyond hockey?
You have to remember, this is a guy who participated in a lot of sports in college, but lettered in only one, soccer,
mm-hmm.
Where he was pretty good. He's very into the purity of competition. You know, and he plays a lot of sports, whether he's very good at them or not. I mean, I've seen I read about one game where they desperately tried to let Kerry score three times so they could say he had a hat trick and couldn't pull it off, even though the goalie was trying to help him. I read another description of Kerry as the kind of guy who sort of turns on his skates and makes a graceful loop instead of racing to the other end after there's a shot on goal and the puck is shot down to the other end of the ice. But he is very intense about it. There's an intensity of competition there, which I do think says something. I mean, when I asked him if college players should be paid, he said, pardon me? Almost like he couldn't believe that I'd asked the question.
Peter, people know George W. Bush as, of course, the former owner of the Texas Rangers. We have a picture of the president hanging in our office in which he's delivering a punishing forearm to the head of an opponent during a rugby game when he was at Yale. I wonder if you plan to offer Mr. Bush equal time, you and ESPN, the magazine.
Oh, we have. We have. And, in fact, the list of questions that we drew up and then edited down for Senator Kerry is identical to the list of questions we could ask the president. And I would love to talk to the president.
Peter Keating's interview with Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry appears in this week's edition of ESPN, the magazine. Peter, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for having me. I'd love to come on anytime.
Our country calls on us tonight, Democrats, good Democrats, to battle bravely for the right. Democrats, good Democrats, 8 years ago we won the prize, and then were robbed by tricks and lies of freedom's foes in friend's disguise. Democrats, good Democrats.
The 2003 Detroit Tigers were so bad that they had to win 5 out of their last 6 games just to finish with only 119 losses. Had they managed to lose just 2 more games, the Tigers would have stolen immortality from the 1962 Mets, who managed to lose an amazing 120 games in their inaugural season. This year, the Tigers, currently 49-54, don't quite have their American League Central Division rivals in a panic, though the Twins and the White Sox are checking their rearview mirrors a bit more often. Ron Schachter reports.
The Tigers are serving notice that it's time to take them seriously. Earlier this month, they matched their entire 2003 win total. They've already won their season series against the mighty New York Yankees, and they've been playing close to 500 ball all year, not that far from the lead in the AL Central Division, and no mean feat since their last winning season came in 1993. First baseman Carlos Pena, who's contributed a 6-for-6 performance in a game-winning grand slam to the Tigers' turnaround, has seen a big change in last year's prolific losers.
Well, I think we've been able to separate every single game, every single pitch, every single play, whereas maybe last year we weren't wise enough or professional enough yet, experienced enough, to understand that there is no relation between your last at-bat and this new at-bat or this inning and the next inning. What I mean by that is that last year we would let negative things pretty much just snowball and get us. This year we're learning how to overcome immediately and make an adjustment immediately.
Starting pitcher Mike Moroth, who came into this weekend with an 8-7 record after going 9-21 last year, has his own explanation.
Just confidence, being able to go out there and not feel like I have to be perfect and not give up any runs. This year we got a team that's put up a ton of runs for us, and knowing that, you can go out there and be a little more aggressive, throw the ball in the zone and make the hitters put in play.
At shortstop, Carlos Guillen. Catching tonight is Ivan Rodriguez.
Those runs are piling up thanks to a trio of players acquired in the offseason by general manager Dave Dombrowski. He's better known for transforming habitual losers like the Montreal Expos and the Florida Marlins into contenders. Besides landing star free agent catcher Ivan Rodriguez with a 4-year, $40 million contract, Dombrowski tapped free agent outfielder Rondell White and traded for shortstop Carlos Guillen, who's hit well over 300 and leads the team in home runs and RBIs. Rodriguez spent last year leading the last-place Marlins to a world championship and has spent this season atop the American League in hitting. He says that experience counts.
This year they signed good players. We play the game hard, and we've been in the league for a long time, so when you have a bunch of veteran players playing on the same team, you know, you're going to do the job, and basically that's what we're doing.
Carlos Pena adds that Rodriguez's approach to the game has had an immediate impact on the team's younger players.
He's a winner. When we see the way he does it, we just say, hey, you know what? If that's going to get me 10 gold gloves, if that's going to get me a World Series ring, then that's the way I must do it. So it just rubs off, that professionalism and winner's attitude and preparation. It's amazing.
The Tigers' fledgling pitchers have thrived under Rodriguez's guidance. Besides Muroth's winning season, the team has seen similar gains from Jeremy Bonderman, who lost 19 games last year, and Nate Robertson, who leads the staff with a 9-5 record. Detroit fans, meanwhile, like what they've seen. Attendance at Comerica Park is up, and season ticket holders like Paul Goldman are watching the team with interest, something that was in short supply last year.
You came for other reasons than watching the Tigers win. You came to enjoy the weather, you watched the other teams, and if you came to the game wanting competition, you're in the wrong place last year.
Manager Alan Trammell says that while the Tigers have come a long way, they're still a work in progress.
Being in the American League, we averaged 3.6 runs a game last year. That's not going to cut in the American League. You've got to basically average closer to 5. The next thing, of course, is pitching, but we know that we're not a finished product yet. We're still working on that. We're still letting some of our younger pitchers develop, and that's how you put together a championship club, but you can't do it overnight.
20 years ago, when Trammell was the star shortstop, the Tigers won 104 games on their way to their last World Championship. This year, they're on track to split the difference between that dream team and last year's nightmare, Trammell's first season as manager. If the Tigers do break even this year, they'll also break a major league record. They'll have come back from 38 games under 500. That would be 20 games better than any team before them. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Detroit.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Obviously enamored of the full-contact chess matches featured in the Harry Potter books and movies, Robert Talley and Robert Henderson of Slidell, Louisiana, have come up with a version of extreme chess all their own. When an argument occurred during a recent match, Mr. Talley grabbed his opponent and rammed his head through a plate glass window.
Queen's bishop takes your knight.
The hell he does!
Mr. Henderson was released from North Shore Regional Medical Center after treatment for lacerations. Mr. Talley was charged with second-degree battery and later released on bond. The outcome of the chess match is still in doubt. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, horse racing all day and all night. But first, in Thursday's pre-Olympic tournament in Belgrade, the U.S. men's volleyball team was defeated by France 3-1. The U.S. dominated international volleyball in the 1980s, though the U.S. team won the bronze medal at the Barcelona Games in 1992. At the 96 Games, the indoor team finished a dismal ninth. 4 years later, they hobbled to an 11th place finish, the worst ever for a U.S. team. But a scrappy young U.S. aggregation is set to return American volleyball to its former glory. From Colorado Springs, Nancy Greenlease reports.
It's no day at the beach on this sunny Colorado morning for the U.S. men's volleyball team. They're inside the Olympic Training Center at Colorado Springs doing serving drills and catching fluorescent rays. The players pounded the pine boards recently, and apparently the pine has been pounding back. Ryan Millar, the starting middle blocker, sprained his ankle a day earlier. Team captain Loy Ball ices his sore knee. But injuries don't worry the three-time Olympian.
Obviously, everyone at this level has great skills, but not everyone has, you know, the heart that it takes to be number one. Sometimes you can overcome a better team, a tougher situation, by just showing that heart. What I mean is never giving up. You know, if you're down 0-2, if you're down 10-0, if you're not playing that well, somehow finding a way to win. It didn't happen for us in 2000. We had a real physical team, but not probably as much heart as this team has.
The U.S. team couldn't find their way out of the losing column in Sydney, going 0-5. The 2000 team's weak bench couldn't carry the team when starters were lost to injury. It's a chronic problem with American volleyball, says 15-year head coach Doug Beal.
One of the things that the U.S. men deal with in our sport, in our country, is that we're not a very deep sport. You know, when we get an injury, it seems to be a bigger hill to climb because it's not as easy to find a quality replacement.
Beal cites a lack of high school volleyball programs and state championships. He says less than 24 universities offer scholarships. Powerhouses Italy, Russia, and Brazil have strong university programs or professional leagues that siphon world-class players to their national teams. Lloyd Ball says the U.S. national team has to choose from a hodgepodge of widely dispersed volleyball players.
Some of our guys have taken the road less traveled to get here. Not all were stars in college. You know, some just went through one-year JUCO, guys from Texas, guys from the Midwest. You're not your stereotypical California well-developed volleyball player. You know, we don't have the greatest volleyball players in the world in our team, but I think we have great personalities, great individuals, strong competitors, and most time I think that's the people who end up on the podium.
Ball had the gumption to turn down Bobby Knight and an Indiana basketball scholarship to play volleyball. Veteran Tom Hoff was not even recruited in high school. The suburban Chicago kid produced a highlights reel that landed him a meager scholarship with Ohio State University. A year or so earlier, he attended the Karch Karai volleyball camp, founded by the legendary veteran of four Olympiads. 16-year-old Hoff played pepper, passing the ball back and forth, with a gold medal winner fresh off his 1988 victory.
Had about maybe a minute or 90 seconds, got on videotape. He gave a little spiel, you know, he wants to check me out to be the next beach partner. And, you know, I still got the tape, and it's amazing to see way back then, you know, and I was thinking, this is the guy I'm emulating. You know, I want to follow in his shoes, and they're awfully big shoes to fill.
Indeed, Karai and his teammates won gold in 1984 and 1988. Some Olympics watchers, however, expect this year's team to bring U.S. volleyball into a new golden era. Hoff contends that such expectations are unfair.
Those teams were unbelievable. To use a word, godly. You know, they were. They could dominate matches, and we're talking 10, 20, 30 matches in a row. They were unbelievable. I don't think any team in the U.S. or the world will ever duplicate what our teams in 84 and 88, you know, they won the triple crown of volleyball. They did things that were unheard of, but the game has definitely changed. It's different now.
Beginning in 1999, international volleyball adopted rally point scoring, in which teams can earn a point on every play, even if they aren't serving. In addition, nearly every team now uses the explosive jump spike serve. Compared to the 80s, the game is much faster and more homogeneous, according to Coach Beal.
In Munich in 1972, you had the Japanese team that had developed some of the quick attack and floor defense and playing an East German team in the finals that never set a ball in the middle of the court, set the ball so high that if you videoed it, it sometimes went out of the frame before it came back in. And we just don't see that kind of contrast anymore.
Yeah, somebody's easy.
In volleyball, attacks that result in points are kills, and 26-year-old Clay Stanley is a killing machine. He's the team's hope for the future and the strongest link to its past. His father was a 1968 Olympian, and his mother competed for the Canadian team. Clay has a serve that's been clocked at 80 miles per hour. That's faster than dear old dad's. But he passes on any comparison.
For me, I don't even think about it yet. It's nothing. You know, I mean, I'm proud of what my dad has done, you know, and who my family is. But, you know, I mean, I'm not playing for them. I'm playing for myself. And because I love this game.
Stanley's teammates hope he can provide enough kills for the U.S. team to move out of an exceptionally tough pool featuring world champion Brazil and perennial favorite Italy. The Americans avoid making any medal predictions, but Lloyd Ball can't help thinking about the tattoo that could join the one he already has of a serpent squeezing a volleyball should his team win it all in Athens.
I went 0-2 with the tattoo before the Olympics, so I really didn't go that route this time. But if something good would happen in this Olympics, I would probably be easily forced into getting another one.
Have you envisioned it?
Yeah, probably similar to what the gold medal would look like if we were to win.
The team's quest for a medal and Lloyd's seventh tattoo begins August 15th. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlees in Colorado Springs.
All right, grab a drink.
Today, the 50th annual Tevis Cup Ride will begin in Lake Tahoe and take riders and their horses over a 100-mile trail through the Sierra Nevada mountains. Those who succeed at the event will arrive in Auburn, California within 24 hours on horses judged healthy by veterinarians on hand to make that determination. With the Tevis Cup to finish is to win, Marnie Langer has written a book about the event she calls, quote, America's most challenging endurance horse competition. Ms. Langer joins me now from the studios of KUVO in Denver. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Wendell Roby founded the Tevis Cup 50 years ago, and I gather that the event couldn't really be termed a competition at that point because the handful of riders on the trail essentially followed Mr. Roby, right?
Well, that is correct. It was developed more out of a challenge and a bet and a dare, mm-hmm. was how the first ride came to be.
What would have happened if somebody had decided to make it a competition from the beginning and just galloped away from Mr. Roby?
I have no doubt Wendell would have been hot on that person's heels, passed them up, and still been first into Auburn.
You've got a story about halfway through the book that reveals several of Wendell Roby's qualities, including the extent to which he was politically connected. The story has to do with a dispute over whether Mr. Roby had the right to cut down some trees on the trail that the race followed.
Yes, Roby was quite a colorful fellow, and politically correct and following all the rules were definitely not in his vernacular. But he really did a lot for that whole area, and he was working on keeping this trail access open, which not only his competition benefited from, but users of the backcountry and the wilderness. And there were some trees in the way that he felt prohibited the better access and safer access to the trail, and some of the Forest Service guys says, you can't cut them down. And he says, well, you just go call up my friend Dick. And they said, what are you talking about? He said, I'll call Nixon myself.
And the permission, I assume, was forthcoming.
Absolutely. When he set his mind to something, not much stood in his way.
Though Mr. Roby and his comrades wanted to ensure that the annual ride did not turn into a race, there did come to be a prize for the horse and rider finishing first. How is the event not a race, then?
Well, it's a fine line. It is truly a competition. The horses and riders are evaluated throughout, and Wendell felt very, very strongly that competition was good for the soul and that challenges and being the best was nothing to be ashamed of. In fact, it was very worthy. But at the same time, he also wanted to encourage people to just come out and experience the wilderness and experience this personal challenge. There is a prize for the first horse across the finish line, but every rider who finishes within 24 hours with a horse deemed healthy and sound by the veterinary panel is also awarded a prize, which is the very coveted Tevis Cup buckle.
There's another prize in the race or in the event for the rider whose horse is in the best shape at the end of the 100-mile ride. The judging must be fairly subjective in that category.
It is, but there's a lot of very established criteria, and the award you're referring to is the Hagen Cup. And many riders consider that an even more prestigious prize than the Tevis Cup, which is the one given to the first place horse and rider. And for the Hagen Cup, you have to be in the top 10 finishers. So you have to be among the top 10. And then on Sunday morning, the veterinary panel gathers, and the audience is welcome to participate in the stands. And the horses are evaluated on their way of going to make sure that they're not lame and that they're still moving freely and comfortably. And then when you see those horses standing and about 15 veterinarians around them all checking their legs and poking their backs and checking their gums and giving them a very, very thorough physical, it's very impressive. And it is subjective, but there's a lot of criteria there.
Pardon my ignorance on this, but it's a little hard for me to imagine how any horse could be in great shape having traveled 100 miles in 24 hours.
You know, I would absolutely agree with you, but I've now been at the finish line of the Tevis Cup since 1991 and covering it for the various magazines I write for. And to see some of these horses appear out of the darkness and prick their ears and trot across that finish line like they'd just been out for a Sunday ride is truly amazing. And it also speaks to the veterinary standards of this event. They're very, very rigorous. And if a horse just doesn't look like he can continue going, they will err on the side of being conservative and pull the horse before the horse gets into trouble, because so much of this trail is in remote wilderness, and no one wants to risk having a horse get into trouble out in the middle of nowhere.
Over the years, the route of the Tevis Cup ride has been changed several times as the country has been developed. But has the race itself had an impact on the populations, the local populations' concern for the environment?
Oh, I think so, very much. Actually, if it weren't for the ride, the entire Granite Chief Wilderness, I don't think, would be as accessible to people. Plus, the organizers, the Western States Trail Foundation, do a remarkable job with trail preservation, and they really balance keeping a trail open, but working in harmony with the environment. And groups and organizations from across the country have come to see and study what these people do with maintaining this remote access trail and then apply it to areas back in their homes. So it's really had an impact on recreation and wilderness areas.
Has that, in fact, led to more events like the Tevis Cup in other parts of the country or other parts of the world?
Well, actually, this event itself gave birth to the entire sport of endurance riding. This is the first organized endurance ride in the modern era, despite the wildly entertaining but not at all truthful movie Hidalgo. And
like so many movies.
Why are we not surprised? But it also had a tremendous impact on just long-distance endurance sport in general. Ultramarathons, which are the 100-mile human counterpart, arose directly out of this event when some fellow was without a horse and wanted to compete. And the ultra triathlons, the Ironman competitions, and the ride and tie events, which is where two people and a horse make up a running and riding team. Mm-hmm. So this event has had worldwide impact on long-distance sport.
Marnie Langer is the author of The Tevis Cup, the story of America's most challenging endurance horse competition, published by the Lions Press. She joined me from KUVO in Denver, Colorado. Marnie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Need to sleep in my saddle. Rockin', 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 rockin' all the day.
Rockin', 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 rockin',
rockin',
rockin',
rockin',
rockin',
rockin',
rockin'
all the day.
You're listening to Only a Game. Somebody somewhere must have recently made a list of greatest pro basketball players ever, and the results have irked at least some Only a Game listeners. Either that, or those listeners have extrapolated all manner of curious conclusions from Florida columnist Dan Le Batard's praise for Shaquille O'Neal on last week's show. In either case, from Virginia, Rich Gregory wrote, quote, "He won the NCAA championship in 1955 and 1956 and was tournament MVP in 55. He won an Olympic gold medal in 1956. He led his team to 11 NBA championships. He won 5 NBA MVP awards and was a 12-time All-Star. How is this man not the greatest basketball player ever?" If you don't know, this man is Bill Russell. I won't tell Rich Gregory, I promise. In a vaguely similar vein, Robert A. Dell, who hears Only a Game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, wrote to suggest that we and you join his campaign to get Artis Gilmore into the Basketball Hall of Fame. From Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, Cindy Shannon wrote to say, quote, "I loved your story about Major League Lacrosse. I'm the mother of an aspiring lacrosse player who is Machiavellian enough to want to get my child into a good school using lacrosse, but still practical enough to encourage him to have a backup career, given the history of niche sports. I just wanted to point out another niche sport that has thrived on the accessibility of its stars, NASCAR," end quote. From Westchester, Pennsylvania, Randy Lyons wrote as follows in response to Ben Trefney's story last week about what some Olympians are earning. "I was horrified, shocked, to hear that only 50 track athletes were making over $100,000 per year. Geez, it's barely enough to get an Escalade properly tricked out. I think of all those school teachers, nurses, and police officers wallowing in their wealth while someone who contributes so much to society by running from here to there a tenth of a second faster than the person next to him or her needs to struggle so. Please let me know where I can send a check to help rectify this awful situation. Your comments, caustic or otherwise, will reach us through the mail at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can contact us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, ponderous polo. But first, I'm joined on the line by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Sunday, just a day after you and I last spoke, Lance Armstrong shocked nobody by winning his sixth straight Tour
de France.
You'll
notice that's another prediction I got right.
I'm keeping track, believe me. Despite Armstrong's unwillingness to rule out a crack at seven straight wins, a dozen or so other riders on the tour have apparently planned to host his retirement dinner. Have I got that right?
Yeah, he announced about three-quarters of the way through that this, if he won, this would be his last one. Now he's decided that winning is every bit as much fun as it has always been. So he's now, you know, I hope they make him pay for like half the dinner. I mean, there's no reason for them to spend all this money and rent at the hall, and he leaves them at the altar.
Former Miami Dolphins running back Ricky Williams abruptly did retire a week ago, and he was quoted in an AP story as having said, quote, "I'm finally free. I can't remember ever being this happy." Should we take him at his word?
I think we should definitely take him at his word as to how happy he is, given the reason why the actual reason why he retired.
Have to elaborate, Mr.
Yes,
Pierce.
Apparently he has failed yet another NFL-sanctioned and required drug test on the subject of marijuana. And he has determined this time, though, that he was clean and had been using masking agents to pass drug tests all during his career. But finally, he went to Europe, where things are a little bit looser about this stuff, and said, hell with it. So he is the first player I know, Mon, to give up the NFL for the herb.
Williams' comments regarding so-called, quote, liquid masking agents have caused a stir in the NFL and beyond. Do you think these detoxifiers are as widely used as Mr. Williams has claimed they are?
If he was using them and never got caught, I will guarantee you that they're widely used. Because anything that's that effective gets around. And quite frankly, given the damage done to the human body by the average NFL season, I'm surprised that half the league isn't on the herb by week five.
NFL teams are convening for preseason training camps, Charlie.
Big day for you.
Big day for me. The story that I liked, though, apparently these are kinder, gentler camps than they used to be. What's happened?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly they used to be, you know, one step up from a chain gang. They are being, you know, more conscious of things like hydration, and they can only work a certain amount of hours during the day and stuff like that. I mean, they're still, by comparison to virtually any other human endeavor, pretty brutal, but they're better than they were.
Well, but does the decreased brutality filter down to the college camps, or are those still going to be tough as ever?
I think they've filtered down a little bit. I think when people start dying on you, you tend to change the way you do business. Of course, college coaches have much more of a whip hand on their players than pro coaches do, so I suspect things probably are a little rougher at the college camps.
The Minnesota Vikings are currently trying out former pro wrestler Brock Lesnar. Are we witnessing the WWE-ing of the NFL?
Well, I think, you know, this is a guy with a lot of size and a lot of obvious athletic ability in terms of his ability to jump around and things. It's certainly a chance that most NFL teams would take. Now, I don't know whether or not they've explained to Brock that the metal folding chairs that are along the sidelines are for the press and not for the purposes of playing the game, but
Well, he's a Minnesota guy, too. He's expressed a certain excitement of at the opportunity to play for his hometown team.
Yeah, I'm sure he has. And given the history that WWE has with performance-enhancing substances, I'm sure he was well-flushed before he showed up at camp.
The subpoenas, unlike the forward passes, are apparently already flying in Tennessee. Attorneys representing a former Alabama assistant coach have accused Tennessee football head coach Philip Fulmer of ratting out their program to the NCAA. But how exactly did subpoenas get involved in all this?
This is a completely new stage in the traditional college football game of turning in everybody for the stuff you do, too. Apparently, the folks at Alabama are arguing in court that Tennessee's what they call negative recruiting has had an adverse effect on the enterprise that is Alabama football. Now, of course they have. That's what negative recruiting is all about. As far as I know, this is the first time that anybody's brought what is essentially a slander action against another program.
On Tuesday, Billy Hahn, the former men's basketball coach at LaSalle University, said that the female student who told him that she had been sexually assaulted by one of his players also requested that he remain silent about that situation. He says that's why he did remain silent. What is the role of a coach in that circumstance?
I think that the role of the coach is to keep the legal process rolling as best he can, and I think this is a very convenient way to look good after you've lost your job because your entire program had gotten out of control.
Los Angeles Sparks center Lisa Leslie scored her 4,000th point on Thursday night, Charlie. She's the first WNBA player to score that many. Does her presence on an already star-studded Olympic roster guarantee a win for the U.S. in Athens?
Were you making book on women's basketball, first of all, I'd throw you in jail. But second of all, I think you'd have to look at them as certainly one of the favorites, yes.
Denver Nuggets prodigy Carmelo Anthony predicts a gold medal for the men's team. Can Melo at all overcome what some say is a lack of outside shooting and beat the Lithuanias and Serbia Montenegros of the world?
Of course he can, because Dwayne Wade is also on the team. But seriously, this is a really good thing for them to have done with the young guys. I don't think they'll be as clearly a favorite as the American women are, but they will be young and enthusiastic and have a great time. And maybe this will be where Allen Iverson makes the statement as the patriot he is.
Finally, Charlie, on Tuesday, 82-year-old Wilhelmus Soren won the first Dutch championship for electric scooter racing, topping out at a speed of 7.5 miles per hour. How long before NASCAR taps into the growing senior citizen demographic?
Well, I don't know about that, but I know that people are already arriving in Florida for the Tour de Red Lobster, which occurs in the parking lot every Friday night for the special.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and gives us a charge each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Has won the most Grand Slam tennis titles? Which manager has won the most Major League games? These are not exceptionally difficult questions, at least for most semi-serious sports fans. On the other hand, how many double stitches does a baseball have? In one episode of Seinfeld, Kramer promises a sick child that a Major League Baseball player will hit a home run for him. Who is that player? If you know the answers to the latter two questions, you'll probably do exceptionally well on the All-American Sports IQ test in the current issue of the Sporting News. Better than I did, certainly. Better than almost everybody on the Only a Game staff did. Almost everybody, because listen to this. At what facility do the Red Wings play their home games?
Joe Louis Arena.
In the episode of The Simpsons where Mr. Burns assembled an all-star softball team, which major leaguer on his team had radiation poisoning?
Whatever, Mike Socia.
You're scaring me.
Sorry.
That's Only a Game associate producer Gabe O'Connor. He flat out knows this stuff. Two World Series ended on homers. Who hit them?
Bill Mazeroski and Joe Carter.
What years?
1960 and 1993. Please!
If somebody put a half grapefruit on the table in front of you, would you eat it with A, a fork, B, a spoon, or C, a lacrosse stick?
A lacrosse stick. I mean, Wait, I'm not sure.
That's the problem, of course. A fellow like Gabe, who scored an unearthly 104 out of a possible 165 on the Sporting News All-American Sports IQ test, is unlikely to have much space left in his brain for anything other than the sort of thing this extraordinarily difficult exam measures. Who was the first designated hitter?
Ron Blomberg of the Yankees, 1973.
How many times have you come in this week with your right shoe on your left foot and vice versa?
Shut up.
To paraphrase a former vice president of the United States, a mind is a terrible thing if it's nothing more than a wastebasket full of statistics and facts like which Heisman Trophy winner passed for the most yards in college.
Ty Detmer.
Thank you, Gabe.
Where are my pants?
For the record, senior producer Gary Wallach scored a respectable 65 on the test. Associate producer Karen Given finished with an exceptionally healthy 15. And my own score was... The Olympics, the Super Bowl, and the World Cups of soccer and cricket are just a few of the world's really big sporting events. But last September, Judith Ritter attended something much, much bigger, and she has this report.
And the ball goes in with 2 minutes left of this final, Sunrise's first shocker of the Annenthaler Gold Cup playoff.
Nothing puts polo fans on the edges of their seats like riders chasing that tiny white ball down the field at full speed.
Welcome to this first day of the King's Cup Elephant Polo 2003. Umpire, ready?
But there's none of that in evidence today, because a competition featuring 6 4-ton elephants carrying sweaty pith-helmeted riders is just a lot slower than polo's equestrian version. Well, it may be slow, but the polo at the King's Cup Elephant Polo Tournament in Hua Hin, Thailand, has a peculiar charm, redolent of British prep schools and a defunct tropical empire. Today, the empire's representatives are a collection of satin-shirted players, ranging from expat Brits, Old World Indians, officers of the King's Royal Hussars. That's the same military group that in 1854 led the celebrated Charge of the Light Brigade, and an absolutely stunning transgender team called Ladyboys.
Andrew Clark, a nice swift elephant, swings it round.
Some of the players here are serious horse polo players. Others, just well-heeled international businessmen looking for something to write home about. But above all, elephant polo is a social event. It's a tailgate party for high society with cucumber sandwiches and champagne rather than hot dogs and beer.
It's a way of life. It's just got to be on your calendar if you can make it. Any excuse for a party.
An elephant polo co-inventor, Jim Edwards, should know. Back in 1982, he helped hatch this idea at the bar of the San Moritz Tobogganing Club, and he sealed the deal over a champagne lunch at the famed Tiger Tops Resort.
I was having a drink at the bar, and a chap called James Manclark came up to me and said, Edwards, you play horse polo. Why don't we do it on elephants? So I had another Bloody Mary, made him pay, and... The deal was I would supply the elephants and he would supply the long sticks. I owned then, I think, 18, 20 elephants down in the jungle, and we played a trial game on our grass airfield. And it seemed to work. We had champagne, we had a very good picnic lunch, and decided this is a sport that we could continue.
And the King's Cup tournament is now a yearly event. A chance to hobnob with old friends whom you haven't seen since quail hunting season. This gang never misses an elephant polo tournament. And it's easy not to, since there's only three. The others, Nepal in December and Sri Lanka in February. The King's Cup tournament, held in honor of the King of Thailand, is surely the most stylish of the three events. The King has never attended, but he always sends a royal representative. The tournament starts with a ceremonial parade with dozens of decorated elephants, Thai dancers and musicians shimmering in silk and gold. Spectators lounge under white tents strung along the field. Smartly dressed waiters provide icy fresh coconut milk and endless alcohol. Out on the field's 100-degree heat, players from Australia, Nepal, Germany, and India ride giant elephants that lumber after the ball with these big ears flapping.
That's Jamie on the top again. Jamie really is having a good match here.
The elephants actually seem to enjoy themselves as they chase the ball down the field. And it's not unusual for the polo pachyderms to ignore their aristocratic riders and kick the ball with their massive gray feet. According to rider Christian Edwards, those feet can sometimes create a problem.
When you hit the ball, you've got to think, where the hell are the legs? The horse's legs are skinny, so you didn't really have to worry about them too much. And also, a horse is galloping, so all four legs come off the ground, whereas an elephant can only walk. So there's only ever 1 foot off the ground. Yeah, so you've got to remember, there's a lot of feet on the ground.
Some of the elephants get so excited, they pick the ball up and throw it with their trunks. Some actually lie down in front of the goal to prevent opponents from scoring. Adding to the difficulty, the riders, the ones with the 8-foot mallets, the white jodhpurs, and the social pedigrees, don't exactly control the elephants. Instead, they give commands to the real riders, or mahouts. Oliver Winter is a horse polo player and last year's King's Cup winner. He says this game of telephone can be a bit frustrating.
You're sitting on a back, like on a huge truck, which really moves slowly, and you have to communicate with the mahout to make him understand what you want, and then he communicates with the animal. Yeah, it was very embarrassing because the mahout has his own idea. So there's always two opinions. The elephant also has his own ideas. It was very weird because when you get onto a horse, you can stop, turn, you can accelerate, you can do whatever you want, and here you're actually not in control of the animal.
The last day of the tournament, monsoon conditions turned the field into a swamp. But in the end, the team led by German heavy hitter Oliver Winter grabbed the King's Cup for the second year in a row. And as usual, with no hard feelings apparent, the victors and the vanquished headed out for another splendid party. If this eccentric and entertaining event seems to be just another indulgence for bored blue bloods, it's also a fundraiser for the Thailand Elephant Conservation Center. That's a group that protects the elephants of Thailand. You can catch the next round of King's Cup this September 5th through 12th. And the pre-tournament scuttlebutt says this time there's probably going to be a prince, a princess, and maybe a maharaja there. Jolly nice, don't you think? I think it's absolutely spiffing.
Look at that wonderful shot right up to his teammate.
For Only a Game, I'm Judith Ritter.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Thanks this week to Only a Game players Matt Odette and Glenn Alexander and to Joey Kloss at member station KUVO in Denver. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or perhaps peruse the photogenic pachyderms of polo, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from ESPN's Peter Keating.
After a week of pretty bad phone and attempted wireless connections, I'm finally on a decent phone.
Recent drone? A specious clone? What's he saying? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.